Hi, everybody, and we're recording today's episode of Adapting on January 24th, 2024, and we are continuing our series about Israel education in a post-October 7th world. Today's episode deals with a particular philosophy or pedagogical approach to Israel education that Jonathan Golden has perpetuated and promulgated through the Jewish educational community, focusing on the heart, head, and hands of Jewish education, otherwise known in the more academic circles as the ABCs, the effective behavioral and cognitive aspects of Jewish education. But I think the contribution today really puts it stark and really puts it out in front of everybody that to be a Jewish educator today, particularly in a post-October 7th world, the need and the necessity to deal with one's own emotions and own feelings and own affective responses before going into the classroom is really imperative. And that's not to suggest that knowledge is not important. But when trauma, and October 7th is nothing short of a trauma on a collective and an individual level, that trauma really necessitates going through that processing even prior to being able to work out what's the knowledge content that we need to actually partake in ourselves and to convey to our students. It's an episode which I think needs for all of us to stop, reflect, and pause about where we are as Israel educators, and it's part of the work that we're doing at the Jewish Education Project continually to ensure that educators take the time for themselves and then go out and learn the necessary pedagogy and skills to be able to take this to the students. In the upcoming months, we are taking hundreds of Jewish educators to Israel to do exactly that and to process for themselves so that they can become better versions of Israel and Jewish educators as well. Thank you as always for listening today, and I'm sure you'll enjoy today's episode as much as I have.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Dr. Jonathan Golden is Director of Wellspring Leadership Initiatives and Interim Director of Boston at the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America. Prior to working at Hartman, Jonathan worked at the Gann Academy in Boston, where he dedicated considerable time thinking about the ways in which we teach about Israel. It's for that reason in particular that we've invited Jonathan onto today's episode of Adapting, and I'm sure you'll agree with me that what he has to share today is well worth today's episode. So, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us on Adapting today.
Thank you for having me, David.
So in this particular case, I think your biography as an Israel educator is really important. So tell the audience how you got into this line of work.
Absolutely. I would say that my journey was more as a Jewish pluralistic educator. And I mean this in the following way. First, in terms of my personal journey, I grew up in a conservative synagogue in Worcester, Massachusetts, went to Reform services at Princeton as an undergrad because my roommate ran them, went to a small modern Orthodox synagogue outside of Boston because my camp friend from Camp Yavne ran those services. I'll come back to that in a moment. And now I go to an independent synagogue called Temple Beth Zion in Brookline. So pluralism has always been a personal part of my life. And those 13 years at Camp Yavne are what really encouraged me to pursue the field of Jewish education and to ask the question about Jewish pluralism and my own identity. That led to my studies at both at Princeton, Hebrew College, and then later at Brandeis, a PhD in American Jewish history. So most of my career was actually in American history, in American Jewish history, and looking at questions of pluralism, which was what brought me to Gann Academy, where I worked for 23 and a half years, a school that was founded when the best-selling book was Jew versus Jew. Why can't Jews all get along with one another? And it's that work that actually brought me to the field of Israel education, because the school about a decade ago said, we want you to help students think about the landscape of American Jewish politics and relationship when it comes to Israel. Could you be involved in that work? That work pretty quickly grew to be becoming the Israel curriculum coordinator at the school and leading a team to develop a vision of Israel education related to the Jewish pluralistic mission of Gann Academy. So I've definitely been involved in Israel a lot of my life. I mean, Camp Yavne was founded in the 40s as a Hebraist camp, deep connection to Israel. But in many ways, the Israel education has been a new chapter, a new part of my work that brought me a year ago to the Hartman Institute, to the current work I do with educators when it comes to Israel education.
All right. So this is a rather simplistic question in some ways, and yet in many other ways, it's the crux of so much of our discussions. Is Israel education a thing unto itself, or is it an integral or core part of Jewish education, and it should be seen in that entity or in that scope of work?
Certainly in the work that I do, I think it has to be part of Jewish education, because the work that I do at the Hartman Institute, we see Israel as a Jewish story and an extension of Jewish identity. Also, the teaching that I've done in adult education in the Boston area is often in synagogue and in Jewish contexts. There certainly can be Israel education that extends beyond that and connects to others. But at least the work that I particularly focus on and the contribution I feel that I can make is thinking about what is that deep connection between one's Jewish identity, one's collective story, and how Israel ties into that.
All right. Now, so let me ask the same question in a more provocative way, not about your work per se, but about your own viewpoint on this. Can you have a good Jewish education today without focusing on Israel?
I don't think that it's possible simply because you have half of the Jewish world lives in Israel. So it's a living, breathing society. I think a lot about Ahad Ha'am's idea about Israel being a spiritual and Jewish center. And no matter where one is on the politics, just the new expressions of Jewish life, the Jewish lives that are being lived there, I think that has to be engaged in some way as part of one's Jewish education in any context.
And I don't want to push this too much, but I think I'll ask the question and we can decide later on whether we want to edit it out. If a Jewish person decides that they want to lead a Jewish life and want to completely extricate themselves from any discussion about Israel or completely exclude themselves from having Israel as part of their world, as a pluralistic Jewish educator, is that person in or out of your conversation in your community?
For me, it really depends on how one defines Israel. I do think for some, it could be that the politics, the state, the government, that's not the center of what they believe in. But I do believe if there's a connection to Jewish education, Jewish life, and the Jewish people, I think to understand Jews who are living in Israel, their lives, their concerns, their sense of Jewish identity, to me, that really has to be at least part of the conversation. Even to say, okay, well, it's a very small part, and I'm very focused on my own community here or where I am. It's not the center of my concerns, but I do think it at least needs to be touched upon. So again, I think it's important often in these conversations to distinguish between when one says Israel, do we mean the government? Do we mean the country? Do we mean Israelis or the people? And at least on the level of the people, I would argue that's a connection that does need to be maintained.
All right. So it's in particular your viewpoints, which you've become very eloquent and outspoken about, especially in recent months, but I know this has predated October 7th for you, that you have spoken and written a lot about this notion of the head, heart, and hand of Israel education. Now, for all of us who are listening who have a background in education, this could be another synonym or analogous to the ABCs of education, affective, behavioral, and cognitive, but you've gone with heart, head, and hand for Israel education. And I wanted to ask you about how you got to this articulation, particularly about Israel education, but prior to October 7th. We'll talk enough about October 7th afterwards, but prior to October 7th, why did you land on the heart, hand, and head vision for Israel education?
I should first say that I developed this vision outside of Israel education. You know, it's fitting that we're recording at the beginning of a presidential year, the New Hampshire primary having just happened. I actually created this module as a class that I developed in the middle of the night, November 9th, 2016, as the 2016 election was unfolding, thinking about how was I going to speak to my students the next morning in my American history class about election, knowing that some were going to be disappointed by the result. A few others were happy with the result. How was I going to keep a classroom? Because another big part of my identity is I'm a big believer in John Dewey and civics education. And I love to talk about elections, but I knew this was a particularly fraught and difficult one. How could I create a framework that was going to keep everybody in the conversation? And as I was thinking in the middle of the night, I realized that there were three different categories that I wanted to talk about. Heart, the emotional space, how my students were feeling. Head, what they wanted to know and understand. And hand, anything that they might want to do as a result. So the next morning, I walked into the classroom, put on a whiteboard, all the students had markers, write all of your feelings under heart, your questions under head, and your thoughts under hand. And I looked at all what the students wrote on the board, and I said, look, we're in a classroom where the focus is always, how do we have a better understanding of what's happening? But I can't be the best educator that I can be if I don't know what's in your hearts, and I don't know what you might want to do with your hands. And with that, we spent some time, and I realized I was going to go right to the head questions that they wanted to answer, but I realized afterwards, I need to spend some time with their feelings and thoughts. So that exercise was more successful than I couldn't have imagined, and I shared it with other colleagues. Over time, I used that with other difficult moments and challenging moments after the Parkland shooting to talk to students about school gun violence, the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter conversations that we had within the school. I use this protocol again. So to tie this to Israel education now on October 7th, when that happened, as soon as I heard it, I was trying to think, what is a tool? What is something that I could give to other educators that might be helpful in this moment, knowing that there was just so much trauma, there was so much to process. And it took me until the morning of October 9th when I woke up. It kind of came like a flash. I really hadn't thought about it because I hadn't used it actually in an education space that, wow, maybe it's this protocol that will be helpful, this heart, head, hand, just as a way for teachers to process for themselves and to process for their students. So that's when I shared a Facebook post about it that morning and used it in a few settings, including that week, and found that it was resonating with people because I think the sequence, I want to say, is what's important here, one of the important learnings. To start with the heart, to open the heart space, and then move to the head, and then move to the hands. Because if one doesn't process the emotions, it's hard to have the intellectually understanding conversations, the political ones. And so that's really how it came to be. Not as something that I think is unique to Israel education. I really think it's a tool that can be used for all kinds of educational conversations.
Okay, so I want to just ask a couple of clarifying questions because I think I heard you correctly when you had the students after the 2016 elections write on the board. You said you usually start with the heart of education. And I thought you were going to say the head.
Well, so again, what I said to them, and I would say in that a classroom, a high school is mostly about the head. But I wanted to explain to them, why was I asking to write in all three categories, even though we were going to spend the majority of our time in the head category? I said, it's important just that you know what's in your heart. And so what happens is when you make that thinking visible by making a writing exercise, and that could be with a whiteboard, that can be with Post-its, there are a number of methods and ways to do that. It makes the thinking visible. And then students can see both, wow, those are thoughts that I didn't write, but I feel in solidarity with them. Or, wow, I actually feel differently than other people in the room. And what happens is sometimes in these challenging conversations, if those things are not made visible, there's all kinds of assumptions, hypotheses, guesses at what people are actually thinking. And this a little bit lowers the temperature and gains a better understanding of who is in the room and what are we all bringing to the conversation. So that's the way in which the heart would show up. It's just kind of briefly looking together. Let's just see what the feelings are. And now we'll get into the questions, which I think made that conversation a little bit more open and people more willing to express themselves and really to try to grasp what they were trying to understand.
So I don't want to overlook this point, Jonathan, but you said you planned a lesson in the middle of the night. And I just want you to dwell a bit about that. How often does that occur to you as a teacher where it's these middle of the night or in the shower or on the run where you're actually thinking and these ideas are coming to you as an educator?
Like the 3 a.m. call that presidents get. Well, so for me, I do my best thinking, I would say, very early in the morning. I've always been that way. So sometimes, yes, the shower, the run, the preparing for the workday. In this particular case, I remember watching the results come in and just thinking, having it turn over and over my head, being on the couch, probably falling asleep, waking up again at certain points and just writing some notes down and thinking, how am I going to respond to this moment? So yes, I think there are a lot of time when it's trying to feel the context of a particular moment and how can I meet the moment as the educator for the students who are in front of me? Again, I think that's a lot of what October 7th, I'm sure, was about for many educators as they were thinking about the weekend to follow. In some schools, the schools were closed that Monday, so it took to the Tuesday to get back to their students. But I'm sure over as soon as they learned those 24, 48 hours, for many educators, thinking at all times of the day, what am I going to do to be there, to be present for my students?
I'm interested also in your background and your experience at camp leading to you wanting to become a Jewish educator. I think in some ways, camp is primarily about the heart. It's the emotional connection to being Jewish. Sometimes you might get into the hand piece where there's some action items at camp, but primarily I think camp is an affective place of Jewish education, with a bit of head involved at certain points. You made the turn to become a school teacher where primarily you're focusing on the cognitive, on the head, the brain, the intellectual pursuit of education as well. Does that ever play on you, or do you try and interweave these more seamlessly than the distinction that I've made?
I do try to interweave them. So first, I was at Camp Yavne at the end of a certain generation. It was a time when we had 3 to 4 hours of classes every day at camp because it was outgrowth of the ProStar program of Hebrew College. And I was one of the last generation where the Pulat Erev, even activity, was to study for the finals for the next day. So I had some incredible teachers who definitely influenced my path to think about the head as well and my own interest in then pursuing Jewish studies. But one of the reasons I was hired at Gann Academy was because of my camp experience. And I would describe Gann in its early years as a mix to aspire to be both a New England independent school and a Jewish summer camp. We used to start the school year going to a camp, having a school-wide Shabbaton or a school-wide retreat, because even the philosophy of the school was you have to form community first before you really can have an effective learning community. And that would involve sports and games and icebreakers and getting to know one another as a community before we do the formal learning in the classroom. So that's always been so much part of the ethos of Gann Academy, was trying to bring the best of the Jewish summer camp world into day school education. And for sure, over many years, whether it was working at those retreats, Shabbatonim, helping with the Israel trip in later years, and being a basketball coach, there are a lot of ways in which I brought some of the skills that I learned at camp into the classroom, because having that form of relationship is what always opens students to want to do the deep and important learning that they do in the classroom.
Now, I promise we will get there, but before we go there explicitly, I want to ask you the question about you positioning the heart before the head and the hands in this particular context, because I think one of the pushbacks in society today in general, and also in Israel education, but let's leave that specifically aside, is that too many people respond with the heart and leave it there. Or I think it's been said, so many people have opinions without actually knowing anything. And I'm concerned about your approach here, in as much as does it actually limit or lessen the role of knowledge and content in education? Or is that not exactly what you're suggesting?
It's a fair question. For me, heart can mean a couple of things. One is that it can have to do with feelings. But two, it also has to do with the stories, the people to whom one connects in thinking about a particular story. So often when thinking about heart, when it comes to Israel education, I will have people reflect, tell me someone that you're thinking about or connected to when it comes to October 7th, or even prior to that, I would say, someone you're thinking about in terms of your own connection to Israel. Hearing those stories and those identities of what brings one to the table to learning or to a conversation, to me, opens the space for when people are listening and hearing one another, especially when you get to the head, when you get to the political, when you get to things that are more controversial. Because it situates people, here's the ground on which they're standing. Here's the perspective from which they are coming. So I don't think it's just about expressing feelings and therefore that's the absolute truth. It's feelings in service of one, giving people the openness and the space to express themselves. And two, my hope is when it works best, when it's well facilitated, for people to better hear one another, to understand where they're coming from when they're asking a question or making a claim or making a point, they can tie it back to, oh, I see why you're coming from that perspective from given your story, here's my story, here's my connection and how I'm thinking about it and what I'm bringing to this conversation.
Is everybody's heart equal in terms of if there's a discussion or a debate or an argument going on between two people and one person says, I feel this, and another person says, I feel that, but one of them is clearly based in or not based in any factual knowledge or content, but it's still a true feeling that they hold. How do you navigate that in a classroom, especially as a John Dewey exponent who in some ways says that any expression is a true and validated experience? But here you're saying that, well, what are you saying?
What I would say is as follows. Sometimes the role of the educator is to be very clear. Here's the conversation we're having now, or here's where we are in the conversation. We're going to start with a place of sharing and processing. Now we're going to move to a conversation of understanding, and then maybe later move to a place of hands. Or to put it in language that we used at GAN, a different way of putting heart, head, hand in the Israel education context in a vision that we developed there was connection, knowledge, and stance. So connection being the people and ideas to whom one connects in the stories, the knowledge being more the facts, the history, the politics, religion, et cetera, and then the stance being the different political perspectives one might have. So in framing any conversation, it's important to distinguish and for the educator to guide students, this is our moment to process together feelings. And maybe this is maybe that's going to be exclusively what this class will be about. Later, we'll talk about other ideas. Or this is a moment we're going to study and talk about the history together from a more academic, quote unquote, objective perspective. Or here's a day we're going to learn about one or two different stances. Let's think about the stances, hear them out, how you might respond to them, how you might question them. That could be with a guest speaker for a whole school to a class or watching a debate between others. So I think the role that the educator can play is really in framing the moment. Is it just about heart, head, or hand? Or is it about integrating those moments? And if it's about the latter, then it's really important for the facilitator to say, here's where we are in the conversation, or I noticed you've made a heart move. Let's now move the conversation to the headspace if that's where the educator feels that's where the group wants to go.
Great. So we're recording this episode over 100 days since October 7th, but in the days just after October 7th, you wrote the following thing, and I'll just read it out, the quote, and then see how true it still stands today. As, this is to quote you, as educators, we are more needed than ever as the Jewish people seek to respond to the horrific events of October 7th in a multitude of ways. By nature, I, this is Jonathan, am a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. Our work in the coming months and years will be harder, not easier than it is now. There is so little we can control about the unfolding of the conflict itself. However, We must realize the power and agency we create by being in community together, and we must undertake the challenging conversations raised by the conflict. Is this something you still hold to today?
I do. And I remember writing those words and feeling that things have gotten harder, not easier, as the months have gone by. Both just that for some October 7th hasn't left, continuing to experience loss as we have in the Hartman community, others have to continue to be worried about hostages, to really think about the emotional toll. And I have found that the hardhead hand was helpful in the early days for many parents, teachers, students to process the moment. And now we've moved on to other conversations. And here I'm really drawing upon some of the wisdom of the Hartman Institute and its Torah, and particularly the lenses of power and vulnerability. In what ways are Jews powerful? And in what ways are they vulnerable? I feel are coming up in all kinds of conversations, both politically, online, and elsewhere. And to help groups kind of balance the both, where Jews might they have power, where might they be vulnerable, is something I've been helping them to think about and navigate. One text that's been interesting and helpful in that is David Hartman's famous piece, Auschwitz or Sinai, which he wrote in 1982, where he's thinking at a different moment, a different wartime moment of the First Lebanon War, of navigating power and vulnerability, of what the turning point of Jewish history might be, and where Israel might have a role in Jews thinking about their own values and their own place in it. And while there are a lot of pieces about that essay that don't connect in the same way to this moment, I have found that this essay has been an interesting Rorschach test. It's been a way that people have been able to reflect upon, particularly the ethics of war, the challenging conversation that people have been having about the war, where people are holding on it now that we are over 100 days since that time.
And what about the particular line about you being a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist? And look, we're recording today, which is one day after the biggest loss of Israeli soldier life in Israel since the war began. And it's particularly like, I imagine it's hard being an optimist at all the time and at times like this. So I'm wondering if you can reflect on that sentence. I'm a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist.
So I was a short-term pessimist when I wrote that, knowing that the days would be more difficult. I could not have predicted a day in particular like yesterday where 21 soldiers were lost, but I knew there'd be more hard days to come and more hard conversations to come when it comes to this war and how it unfolds in however many phases it will take. My hope to be a long-term optimist is to draw upon a quote attributed to Mark Twain, "History doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes." And my one prayer that if there is a rhyme of this moment, it may look something like one of the moments that's been referred to a lot since October 7th. That's the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War, which was incredibly difficult in many ways. But what happened over time was that over years, it led to new thinking about the region and ultimately did lead to peace with Egypt. It led to a realignment, a rethinking about, okay, if war is not going to be the solution, how might we be able to think in new and different ways going forward? I don't know exactly if that history is going to rhyme or repeat itself now, but the hope is new thinking, perhaps in the aftermath of the Abraham Accords, perhaps given how other neighbors are thinking and discussing about it. And it doesn't feel like anything that's immediate that's going to happen tomorrow, the next week, the next month. But a part of me says, in the long run, in being that long-term optimist, sometimes it takes a great trauma, a great shaking up to cause people in situations to think differently. So maybe from a geopolitical perspective, maybe when it comes to this conflict in this moment, there may be some glimmers of hope that will be realized over time.
It's also interesting in many ways that I'm not sure if John Dewey says it explicitly. I think he does actually say it explicitly at a certain point, that the true educator must be optimistic by design and in their DNA. If they're not, then what's the purpose of their actual endeavor? And in some ways, your response is a geopolitical level, but I imagine also as an educator, you don't walk into a classroom thinking that things are going to come out worse than they were before you walked into the classroom. You're obviously going in there every time with a mindset that you are going to make the lives of these students better, ultimately the community better, the world better. It's almost in our DNA as educators to have to be optimistic. In fact, I have said to audiences before that as soon as you lose your optimism, you've probably talked yourself out of the profession that you first signed up for.
I think that's a great point, that you have to believe in people's capacity to change, to think, and to grow. And it brings me back to some of my teaching of civics, where I know from studies, the form of beliefs that one has for their life are based on events, experiences that happen between the ages of 15 to 25 for high school students, for college students, and for young adults. That's what attracted me and excited me about doing the work at Gann Academy for 23 and a half years, working with high school students at the beginning of that journey, thinking about how historical moments, their classroom experiences, their cohort, what is happening in the world was going to shape their worldview, not being able to predict it, but being a one part of that conversation. And to me at the Hartman Institute, what I'm appreciative of is the wellspring division that's been developed between the ages of 15 to 25 is focused exactly on that cohort. And through high school, college, and young adult experiences, how could we as an institute with my colleagues think about how young adults shape those moments? And so, yes, and I think that is about a long-term optimism. Even in the most difficult of moments, what will one use as one thinks about one's, in this case, Jewish civic identity, Jewish communal identity, in thinking of the context of this tremendous tragedy of this moment? How will that activate one? In some cases, we've seen a growing interest in one's Jewish learning and Jewish identity. In other cases, the desire to become more civically involved, to think more about Israel, to travel to Israel, and so on. How is that going to be captured? I think it's one of the greatest questions that we have in the field as Jewish educators, is thinking about what do we make of this moment that can be a glimmer of hope, that can be a sense of optimism.
So for the last few months, you've had the ability also to travel to other communities, to meet with many educators and many students as well. What are you hearing and seeing, both for better and for worse, I guess, in the field today? Are you seeing anything that surprises you, or at this stage, nothing surprises you? The good, the bad, the ugly, like what are you seeing in Israel education today?
So one thing I would say that somewhat surprised me, even though in context maybe it should not, is especially in the early days and perhaps still some to today, the fear of the physical safety that some students had of just being in their communities and then processing that, how publicly should they be Jewish or not? And being in a number of conversations where some students say, of course I'm going to be publicly Jewish. I'm going to be even more than ever wear a Jewish star or think about my identity. And others saying, I'm not sure. I feel a little bit more afraid about that. How vulnerable students were about that, I think, is one of the biggest surprises and themes that came up early in the conversation. I think that groups are also, again, going back to this idea of power and vulnerability, really trying to navigate that. I support the war and I have questions. What's my place in the community in those moments? I've really appreciated how vulnerable and open communities have been around that. And I think the Hartman Torah of power and vulnerability has helped people to process that. How do we balance the sense that Jews at the same time are both powerful and vulnerable? That in many ways, October 7th evoked in them, as it has many in the community, the Holocaust, the 1929 Hebron pogroms, particularly for those in Israel, maybe going back to the 1881 pogroms, those who have memory of why people like my great-grandparents emigrated to this country and the reason that I'm here. But at the same time, the sense of Jewish power, there is a Jewish army and a state. And how do I think about all of those things at the same time, which are very complex? I think that's still an area where people are wrestling and processing together. And through a combination of sometimes heart-head-hand processing, but also looking at the wisdom of Hartman Torah, pieces like David Hartman and others, I've really appreciated and understood how and why communities are wrestling with those deep questions.
Jonathan, I'm going to ask you a question now as if you're my teacher, which you are, but the teacher of this audience. I think this is possibly a manifestation of the most common question being asked, at least in progressive circles today, and I use progressive loosely in terms of describing the socio makeup of the Jewish community in North America today. I love the Jewish people. I like being Jewish, but I cannot sit back any longer and watch innocent Palestinian lives being killed in Gaza. Teacher, tell me how I should feel and respond to those feelings.
So first, I'd be appreciative for any student who would share those feelings and express them. And for me, if they're expressing through a sense of Jewish values, I would hear and understand them. To me, I would really want to understand the particular educational context in which I was meeting with a student. So that could be, in one context, it could be an alumnus who's trying to speak to me and figure out what's their individual political position in the world. In other contexts, it could be an adult education class where our goal is to come to knowledge and understanding or figure out, or maybe one of the goals is to be in a synagogue community, which I've done before. How do we just stay in conversation and community with one another and being in that dialogue? So it's a real voice that people have and understandably. Questions. And I think even here as part of the discourse within Israel itself, questions about what should happen next when it comes to the conduct of the war. So to name those thoughts and feelings is important to say. In the educational context in which I am, my goal is not to get people to any particular stance. My goal is really about understanding, connection, and definitely through my work at the Hartman Institute, to see Israel as a Jewish story, as I mentioned before. But I do not see my particular role as to be the one to convince them of any particular position. My hope would be to give them thoughts, questions, ideas to continue to wrestle with. What brought them to that position, and how do they hope to actualize their Jewish self in the world?
Because it doesn't take much to uncover in that question, and believe me, I've heard that question now literally hundreds of times being asked in all of the different settings which you describe, is the person is quite possibly suggesting, and I don't know exactly because each person is individual, that they're starting from a position where Jewish pride is something which they feel and want to express, and being part of a Jewish community is something which fills them with this amorphous thing called pride. And yet some of the actions that they're witnessing or hearing about, largely on social media, but they're still hearing about them or being made to feel about, mm-hmm. are giving them a sense of shame, embarrassment, avoidance, almost the opposite, the antithesis of pride of what they're seeing. And being able, especially as a young person, to navigate this duality of pride and shame, I think is going to be one of the most complicated issues of our time moving forward. And I think it's really real, even though I might have particular political or ideological or objective so-called responses to that, it's very hard to negotiate this balance between pride and shame.
I agree with you. So first, I would love to know from that particular student to hear more about what does give them Jewish pride, and to be sure to enforce that, because I think that's something in our world that cannot be taken for granted, that the student has that pride, and to understand what are ways to cultivate that. For sure, again, the war is very much the focus now, and it will not be the focus forever. And so the question is, what is it that can keep that student engaged in a sense of Jewish pride? And to think with them, if they are concerned, and they do want to be in conversation with those who are concerned about what's of the shame and what's unfolding, they do have a space to process that. I think that that's really important. And it's important to name that, there may be questions that people have. I think Israeli society, too, again, has questions. And there will be an inquiry that will follow the war of questions of what will happen and of what the tactics have meant thus far. So the fact that the student is being in conversation at all, to me, like, that's the most encouraging part of this story. I worry about the students who don't want to engage, who feel those things and therefore want to cut themselves off from the community, wouldn't reach out to an educator, wouldn't want to express the complexity. The fact they have that sense of trust to be in conversation, to be open about those feelings, to me, will be a sign of great hope and positivity.
So you also meet with lots of Jewish educators as well. And I'm wondering if your heart, head, and hand message also resonates with Jewish educators. In some ways, the hand part takes care of itself. Like, their job is to do the stuff, right? But heart and head, especially for Jewish educators, seems to be a really, really promising, useful tool here when trying to give some sort of prescriptive chizuk or prescriptive strength for Jewish educators today. But I'm wondering for you, what would be the message you want to send to Jewish educators today who are somewhat struggling with how to talk about Israel with their students?
I think it'd be helpful for them to go through this process. They could do a self-assessment on their own, but ideally in a team, in a group setting of colleagues. I know administrative teams who have done this together. I've done this with full faculty at some schools. And just the processing for themselves before they think about what they want to say to teachers, to be sure that that processing space happens, and it happens from time to time, where they can express their own hearts and their own heads. I've used the analogy before as someone who travels on airplanes about the oxygen mask and the pre-flight instruction. When the oxygen mask falls, put it on yourself before you give it to others. And I do think it's important that there are spaces created for educators to build their own capacity. And that means their own processing space. And I've spoken to educators. I mean, there are many, particularly Israeli educators with family and friends who they've lost or hostages, who are finding it really hard to be in the classroom day to day, how much they really rely on one another to do that kind of processing with each other in small ways, sometimes in more formal ways, to be sure they're fully present in the classroom. Because the formula, I believe, is when you know what's in your heart and you tie that to what's in your head, then you'll know what to do with your hands. And I know as educators, people are so excited to do, to be present for their students, and sometimes jump to, well, here's the thing they need to understand, or I know exactly what I want to do, without having slowed down to take a breath. Where am I in this moment? How am I showing up in the classroom? Those things are really important to be successful and supportive of students.
Jonathan, how do you maintain joy as an educator in difficult times like this?
So part of it is to create the heart space that we talked about earlier. For me, you know, my escape happens to be English Premier League soccer. I really enjoy watching. So sometimes just tuning out the world for a little bit and engaging in something different. I think the mind needs to rest and can't be constantly ruminating and focused on one thing. to be with family, to have a real support system. And I'm lucky. I happen to be in a household. My wife's profession is as a school counselor. So she thinks a lot about the social emotional in an elementary public school level. So for us to be able to process and to be together. And for me, lucky to have a wonderful synagogue community too, of people who are very supportive to me in these times. So all of those things are things that I need in my life to bring me joy and to enable me to continue to do the work that I do.
And who's your English Premier League soccer team?
Arsenal.
Previous guest of ours, Rabbi Danny Berkman, is Liverpool, so
okay.
Also based in Boston. So we'll see if we can play that one out
yes.
at a later time. I want to make this really explicit for all the listeners today in terms of, I can say this as a vast mass generalization without any research or data to back it up, but that many educators, and in this context, I think I'd add clergy as well, often hide behind their jobs and get straight to the action piece of doing what they need to do to serve their students or their congregants. And they don't take the time that's necessary to process for themselves and to deal with their emotional state, their heart state, before going straight into action and straight into to doing what needs to be done. And I want to argue, on top of what you've said and to really amplify what you've said, you will become a better educator if you first go through the process of dealing with your own heart before going into dealing with the students themselves. And I think that message here should be very clear for all of our listeners out there, anybody involved with education or any service industry, by the way, that the events of October 7th in particular are just too traumatic for us individually and as a people for us not to process for ourselves before slipping straight into our professional roles. Jonathan, is there an educator in your life who was really inspired and transformed and helped to make you into the educator you are today?
There are so many, and I thought a lot about this question. The one I want to single out is Professor Jonathan Sarna, my dissertation advisor at Brandeis, for three particular reasons. Number one, the expressive joy that he brings to his teaching all the time is something I aspire to do when I teach in the classroom. Number two, he's someone who's deeply knowledgeable about the past, but knows how to tie it to the present, to contemporary questions. And number three, he's truly been a lifelong mentor. And I know that I'm not just saying that for myself, but all the students who he's advised and people that he's worked with, he's always reaching out, thinking about his students, how he can continue to support them. He's the person who connected me to my opportunity, which led to Gann Academy. And I was lucky enough when I was there for 23 and a half years. Before I left, I was the only teacher to have been on campus with every single student who ever graduated the school. So at the time, it was 1,500 alumni. And when I would speak to them before they would leave, I would say, your GAN experience is for 4 years, but your connection to the GAN community is lifelong. So certainly then, through the years, many students would come back to me with questions about Israel and college campus, their own professional journeys, how I could be of help to them, or many other of my colleagues at GAN. And those relationships continue. So part of it is not seeing the teaching moment as discrete in and of itself, whether it be a class or even having a few classes with a student, to be open and available and connected to students when they have questions and they want to think of the world about their own life or professional journey, that you are there for them to be a sounding board, to be a thought partner in that way.
Great. You're making me think of a future episode that I want to have about mentors and mentees in Jewish education. Just a quick question while I've got you here. Do you formally ask someone to be your mentor, or does it just happen organically?
I find in most cases it happens organically when you do the work together, when you build that sense of trust. Because when I think about, in many cases, the people who have been my mentors, I don't think I can't remember a formal ask, will you be my mentor? Sometimes I would say, can we have a conversation about, which implied that mentorship relationship? But I think in most cases, it's more implied than explicit. I know it can work in other settings. There is a sense of being a formal mentor to a colleague in schools, which I've done before. But the ones that are really impactful in life, I find more come out of the organic living and learning together.
Jonathan, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today and have this conversation. As always, I learned so much from you, and I know our listeners have as well. I really do believe that this heart, head, and hand vision for Jewish education and for Israel education will have a lot of resonance with a lot of folks listening today, and I think it has a lot of promising contributions to make for the field moving forward. So really much appreciated for you being here today and for all of the work that you do.
Thank you, David.
Today's episode of Adapting was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Miranda Lapidus. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. If you've enjoyed Adapting this season, and particularly today's episode, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, or even better, share this episode and others with your friends. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, visit us at jewishedproject.org. There you can hear more about our mission, history, and staff. And as always, we are a proud partner of UJA Federation of New York. Thank you, as always, for listening today.